Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness. This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say it's so what?
The police in riot gear with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
Recognition of Guaido.
Unelected gobshite.
Is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and so I would reprimand you over that.
Hello and welcome to another episode of I Foresee Trouble with Daly and Wallace.
And the Mighty Queen,
obviously. This week has been a busy one for us here in the Parliament. Mick and Claire are both back from missions, in Mick's case from Mozambique, where he went with the Parliament, in Claire's case from Ireland also.
Yeah, but how the world is poorly divided, there's no doubt about that.
Well, hold on a minute now. Wasn't all fun and games, I can tell you.
Mm.
Yeah, so in addition to that, we've got some groups over from Ireland for some big events as well this week. So we're going to start off by talking about the missions, then maybe go through those events, and then onto a bit of foreign affairs, the usual. So Mick, do you want to take us away with your trip to Mozambique? What was happening there?
Right, okay. We're here over 3 years, 3.25 years at this stage, and it was my first official mission with the European Parliament. We've gone to several places, as many elements of the media were quick to tell you. There were ones that we organised ourselves. But this one was organised by the Security and Defence Committee. And there was one member going from each of the seven groups. And I decided I'd go to see what it was like. I knew very little about Mozambique, but I bought a book on it and downloaded a lot of information about what was going on in the country before I went. So in order to know something about it, it was a kind of a mad one. First of all, it was too short. Didn't get enough time there. Didn't get enough time to meet ordinary people. Didn't really get time to even walk the streets. A bit mad. It was one meeting after another. Yeah. 13 meetings. Landed there. Airwise, you're spending about 15 hours in the air. It was a mad trip. Anyway, but what were we doing there?
Exactly.
And who she meet?
The EU were spending money in Mozambique. We're spending over 100 million a year. 109 million we're spending this year. And probably a bit more next year. So what are we doing there? We went to see two EU training missions. Now, you wonder, well, who are we training and why? Well, they're training young Mozambique guys to be soldiers and prepare them for fighting. And you'll say, well, why is that going on? Well, there wasn't any great lot of trouble in Mozambique until the last couple of years, right? And what happened was there was a gas field discovery in the northern province of Cabo Delgado. And it's predominantly Muslim. Huge gas find, and obviously the oil companies of the world were very interested, and two European companies went down to look at excavating the gas. One of them was Total Energies from France, and the other was Eni from Italy. And the Total Energies wanted to clear land so that they could start operating and excavating gas from this region. And they moved over 2,000 farmers from their land against their will. They hired their own soldiers to carry out their wishes, and things got violent, and a lot of unrest with the locals, and guns came into the equation, and before you knew it, there was fighting. Then the Mozambique army got involved. Then you had Islamic fighters from outside the country, more than likely from Tanzania and Rwanda, which border Mozambique. They got involved, and things were getting worse. So now The EU are down there now spending EU taxpayers' money training young Mozambique soldiers to fight against these Islamic fighters in Cabo Delgado. And you'd say, well, why are we doing that? Well, obviously to facilitate the European oil companies who want a clear field to operate. This is mad stuff. And now I'm going to just my last point to tell you how mad this is. Mozambique is suffering dramatically from the impact of climate change. Thousands of lives are lost with typhoons and hurricanes every year. They're getting really hammered, right? As most countries down in that region of the planet are. And the truth be told, I've actually read where if Total Energies or any were to start excavating for gas, start drilling next year, that they reckon it could be at least 4 years before they'll be selling any gas. It could be 2030. And they reckon it'd be 2040 before they make money. Now, the government have said, because we challenged the government on it, and they said that 10% of the profits would be ring-fenced for the people of Mozambique. Now, we never know whether that would ever happen. But the truth is that the people who will make the most money if this gas is explored are the oil companies. And these are European oil companies, and we're prepared to train soldiers to make it happen. But it's an environmental disaster. The International Energy Agency, a UN body, has said that under no circumstances can we open more new gas or oil fields if we want to stop the planet from warming. That because starting now, you're locking yourself in to more filthy fossil fuel for a very long period, many, many years. If they're not going to make money until 2040, right, they're not going to stop before 2050. And this is nuts. And the planet is burning.
I mean, one of the things that struck me, Mick, as you were talking, is that this search for alternative sources of energy now is being accelerated because of the war in Ukraine and the desperate attempts by the sort of US, NATO, EU authority to break the link with Russian energy and so on. So what we see is actually modern day colonialism, really. And I'm interested in these sort of innocuous sounding training missions. Because, of course, we know Ireland, for example, has been involved in training missions in Ukraine over the past number of years. Is there any sign of any Irish lads involved in any of those training missions or anything? Or have they been? I can't remember.
No, there was no Irish guy in either. I was at two missions. Now, and in fairness, right, they were from all across Europe, right? But there were generally four or five countries in each mission. And in fairness, you know, they're real good people, like, you know, they're good soldiers, right? Just doing what they were told and what they're paid to do, right? I mean, they're training Mozambique soldiers and you'll find that they're training them well. But is this how we should be using European taxpayers' money?
Yeah, and I mean, it's entirely different. Like years ago, members of the Irish Defence Forces kind of went to work in Africa, helping new African states to train up their defence forces to defend their own territories. It's an entirely different matter going in on training missions to be the sort of boot boys for multinational oil companies, really, you know. And that's what the EU is at, despite all their shock and awe about the Russians being in Africa and the Chinese being in Africa and going, sorry, lads, they're advancing their own economic interests. That's what you're doing as well, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone's out for themselves there. For
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. And I mean, it does tie in as well with I know people at home will have seen on their TV screens the devastation caused in Pakistan, right? Where they reckon that 80% of the animals drowned, and this is a country that their primary source of income is agriculture. Can you? I mean, if that figure is accurate, though, I read that. I have no evidence that it's 100% true. But obviously, the devastation was incredible. Millions and millions have been displaced. Right, Pakistan emits less than 1% of all the emissions in the world. Pakistan is the fifth largest country per population. They have 250 million people. The fifth largest in the world. They are the eighth country in terms of suffering the impact of climate change, and they're only emitting less than 1% of the emissions. The developed world, which is largely responsible for the climate change that we are looking at today, refuses to pay for loss and damage that they have caused. We, the developed world, have caused climate change. The poor countries are suffering from it because they're in different parts of the world and the impact is far greater on them. And they are just getting poorer and poorer, and we are not compensating them for the damage that we did.
What was the figure for the amount of financial support Europe gave Pakistan after the floods, just to contrast that with Mozambique, for example?
Yeah, the initial figure I seen was like it was 1.7 million.
Something like that, yeah.
Oh, for God's
sake. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. When you look at the hundreds in Mozambique per year.
The floods have cost Pakistan over 10 billion, but we're spending 109 million in Mozambique this year. And don't forget that since 2015, the European Union has spent 8 billion in the Sahel, where we're doing the very same thing as what I suspect is starting in Mozambique, where we have, there's 20,000 troops from Europe down in the Sahel fighting against Islamic fighters. They're called jihadists or they're called terrorists, or whatever. You can call them what you like, but the wheels are coming off and things have got, we have troops down there since 2013. The Burkina mission that was started by France, right? And things have got worse ever since. Over 70% of the people are in poverty. Illiteracy rate is over 70%. It is shocking what's happening there. And the EU has spent 8 billion euros since 2015. And I've asked the Court of Auditors to investigate what was the money spent on? Was it value for money? Where's the evidence?
Well, von der Leyen did say the EU would prioritise Africa, and this is what they mean, clearly. Yeah. No good for the Africans, mind you.
So I think that all that really shows is the value of going on the trips to see where the EU money is going, to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It was a real tough trip because of the time and the flights, the whole lot. I mean, I was back in Brussels on Wednesday night at midnight. I arrived in Mozambique. I left on Sunday evening at 4 o'clock. I arrived in Mozambique at 6:30 in the morning. And we believe it, the time zones are identical. If you look at the map, Mozambique is almost directly below Brussels. Yeah, right?
Cool.
So same time zone. And then 13 meetings. And then up at 6 in the morning on Wednesday morning to spend 17 hours to get back to Brussels.
Wow. So Claire, on to
yes,
a different mission.
I feel a bit embarrassed now having to talk about mine in Ireland. But yeah, different trip. And I mean, unlike Mick, like I have been on mission before. I was in one in Bulgaria. And they are interesting because it's quite formal. And you do get access to sort of really high level people when you go to these countries. Like we met the president of Bulgaria before and that sort of stuff. So it is kind of interesting. But sure, look, I was in Ireland. I was at home. I think the MEPs were quite shocked that I knew everybody who we met already. And they kind of began to realise what a small place Ireland was. But this was a Libe Justice Committee mission to Ireland to investigate the data protection issue, because Ireland is the lead supervisory authority for data protection in the European Union as a result of the fact that we have all of these giant multinational big tech corporations in Ireland. And the GDPR legislation, which was set up to protect people's data, and which myself and Mick were involved in the Dáil in working through the Irish legislation to take effect of that, means that most of the cases in Europe have to go through Ireland first. Now, there is a story that prevails. It's this called a one-stop shop in Europe, that basically the problems in data protection, and it's this easy story to understand, lie at Ireland's door, that the bottlenecks and the problems are all because we have this lazy, incompetent Irish data protection authority. That can sound like an attractive, easy narrative, because there's some NGOs and some activists making those points. So you have big, bad state up against heroic activists. But it's all a bit easy. And I mean, the first thing to say is that we don't wear the green jersey. We're very proud to be Irish. We're proud of our country. But we're not going to hide crimes when they exist. So we were the ones who moved amendments at the plenary to call out Ireland as a tax haven, which it is. So we're not ashamed on that. But actually, in relation to the Irish Data Protection Authority, Europe has got it wrong and has got it demonstrably wrong. And I suppose years ago when we were in the Dáil, we were one of the biggest champions of arguing for the Irish Data Protection Commissioner to be well resourced. And it's absolutely true that many years ago when the great Max Schrems computer activist and digital rights activist took his case to the Irish Data Protection Authority. He was told it was frivolous and vexatious and to go away. That complaint went on to be one of the biggest cases which struck justice for data users around Europe, because he got struck out the arrangement between the transfer of data between the EU and the US. So it was a great case. But the point I would make, and I try to make to colleagues from the rest of the European Union who went on the delegation, is that that was when the Irish DPC had three staff and they were over a Centra shop in Portlaoise. Now they have nearly 200 staff, and they are probably actually the lead authority in Ireland, which sounds a bit in Europe in terms of data protection matters. So it was really interesting because we met some NGOs, but the NGOs we met were the ones who agree with the European narrative that the problem in data protection in Europe is the Irish DPC, which to me does an injustice to data users, because if we're burrowing down this rabbit hole of blaming the Irish DPC, then the real problems that exist, and there are real problems, are being ignored. And that's a huge problem. And sadly, one of the reasons why they're being ignored is some inaccurate figures that have been produced, poor comparisons with the legislation, drawing inaccurate conclusions from that data. So to put it mildly and not bore listeners, because data protection is a bit of a snooze fest sometimes, there's an argument going on there. But we're very confident that we have the right figures, and we're very confident to say that actually the Irish DPC is doing a really good job. So I suppose we met the NGOs, we met the big tech companies who are obviously going to try and get away with whatever they can get away with to make money for themselves. And they do happen to be in Ireland. And of course, there's a bit of jealousy, because if you like the German DPC or whatever, the Germans think they're the only ones who can do data protection, that they know everything and everyone else is an idiot. So they wanted to have that anyway for themselves. So there's a bit of a turf war and a history going on here. But yeah. I mean, it's funny. I mean, people in Ireland would appreciate this more than in Europe. But actually, some of the people in the delegation nearly kind of thought I was an agent for the Irish state, which was absolutely hilarious, given the rows that we've had with the Irish Justice Department. But look, we're not afraid of equally calling things out and defending a state or organisation when it needs to be. And I have to say, the Irish DPC, I'm not saying they're perfect. If they were perfect, they'd be the only organisation in the history of humanity that is. But they're doing a really good job. And I think that the story needs to be corrected. So I was glad I was there to kind of assist colleagues in understanding that some of the problems is the legislation in Ireland, where we don't produce decisions because we try and amicably resolve things. But in other countries they do, so the comparisons are unfair. But really interesting trip. We met the Minister for Justice, we met the Justice Committee. Brilliant for me to get back and meet old colleagues in the Dáil and all the staff and that kind of thing. But yeah, not as sexy as Mix, I'm afraid.
But an interesting issue all the same. So I suppose the questions around digital rights, privacy, all that bring us quite neatly to one of the events that we had on in the Parliament this week, the screening of the new film Ithaca, about the campaign to free Julian Assange. Claire, do you want to tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, I mean, look, we've had a busy week and like this place is crawling with people all the time. But we were honoured, I suppose, again, to receive John Shipton, the father of Julian Assange and a good friend of ours nearly at this stage. He's been over so much. And the film is really about the human story behind the struggle to free Julian. So it's called A Father, A Family, A Quest for Freedom, justice. For Justice, for Assange then in it. But it's really good. A documentary maker, Niels, followed the John and Julian's family around really for a couple of years and got this footage. But it was very much the personal story. It was quite striking. It's kind of hard for me to explain it, but I suppose people should try and go and try and source the film for a very small free. You can get it to show to a crowd or whatever.
You can get it online.
You can get it online to rent. Very nominal fee for that, but I think it's very good because it puts the political parameters of the issue, but also the human side. And one of the points we showed a clip on it saying that the publications that Julian is now being prosecuted for, he's been 3 years in a high security prison in Belmarsh, the film deals with a lot of that sort of stuff. But the publications for which he is being prosecuted were the publications that got him an audience in the European Parliament in 2010. And we played a clip. He was invited by the Renew Group, which Fianna Fáil is in, they were called ALDE at the time, to laud him because he was winning all these awards and everything. And he warned about, I suppose, what has come to pass in terms of silencing dissent and so on. And here we have a journalist basically facing life imprisonment in the US. He's on the verge of extradition to the US, and not a single EU institution is clamouring for his release in the interests of his life, freedom of expression, a free media and so on. It's utterly scary because, you know, he was the one who exposed the war crimes through WikiLeaks in Iraq and Afghanistan. And those are precisely the publications he's been done for. So the chilling effect is there. If you talk up against the US, your history.
Well, it's funny, but it kind of linked a bit with our committee this morning. We both had 2.5 hours at a joint committee discussing Russian disinformation and propaganda.
Again.
And we both pointed out the fact that anyone who dares to challenge the mainstream narrative is challenged, is huge efforts made to silence them. It is no longer acceptable to challenge the mainstream narrative. And, for example, on the Russian-Ukraine war, while we've been at pains to point out that we oppose the war, we think Russia's invasion of Ukraine was illegal, it was wrong, but we've been vilified for calling for peace, diplomacy and dialogue, which is the way to end all wars. Now, there's the fact that there's been a complete lack of coverage of the anti-democratic actions taken by Zelensky's government is actually a form of disinformation and propaganda in itself. And people that dare to challenge that are finding themselves sidelined and maligned, just like Julian Assange. And if you listen to RTE today about reporting from the war, it is reports from the Ukraine government. Now listen, we think it's terrible what's happening in Ukraine, and it's terrible that so many less well-off citizens of Ukraine are dying. It is horrific. But we're getting a completely one-sided story about what's happening in the war. I'd believe neither side in the war. I don't believe the Ukrainians, and I wouldn't believe the Russians. But RTE are not getting any independent news from Ukraine. So I don't believe most of what they're saying. The same as I don't believe most of what the Russians are saying. And we don't have, they don't obviously have independent people on the ground. They don't seem interested in accessing any independent coverage that may be going on in the country. But a lot of this is not unlinked to Julian Assange. The chilling effect of what they've done to Assange. He was locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy for over 7 years. He's in prison for over 3. So he's locked up for over 10 years, right? And his crime is that he actually told the truth about US NATO war crimes in Afghanistan and in Iraq. That's his crime. And the effect of keeping him in prison and having him rotting away there, one procedure after another, being bet down, making sure that he doesn't get out. The impact of this on mainstream media is obvious in its coverage of the war today in Ukraine.
Mm. Yeah, no, and it's great. And it does show the toll on the family. Like, obviously, Julian is rightly the centre of the attention. It's a campaign to free him. But to keep that battle centre stage, you kind of forget about the toll it takes on the family behind the scene, and the film deals very, very well with that. So we strongly encourage people to go to that, to go and download it if you can. We were really heartened. We had a full house, and quite a number of MEP colleagues from across the political groups attended, which was great, you know.
And what I really liked about the film was that it wasn't acting. It was a cameraman following John and Julian's, who is now, well, there was a fiancé at the time. Now they're actually married. But and you had John's kid involved. You had Julian's two kids involved. But it was just showing them in real life. And you can see that there's no acting taking place. There's some there were some real kind of mad scenes where it was just so natural. Like you almost wonder, oh, why didn't the colours?
Yeah,
you know,
I was
there was one particular scene which I mentioned to you, which I thought was mad, right? What's her name is again?
Stella.
Stella. John and Stella were heading for the court one morning, and Stella says, "I think we're going to need security." And John says, "Okay," and then he says, "Well, what kind of security are you talking about?" And then they're walking along, and she's pushing a buggy with one of the kids in it, right? And they're walking along, and she says, "Security for you and me to get in now to court." And John says, "Oh yeah, right." And it was obvious that John wasn't interested in getting security to go in now to court, right? But they didn't cut it. Like it was just the film was so natural that it was obviously left in, like, you know.
No, it was great, and it is a reminder how this is the press freedom case of our generation, and it's constantly gobsmacking that the establishment continues to ignore it because of its ramifications. So look, I think we were all heartened, and MEP colleagues, to redouble our efforts over the next while, certainly on that issue. Just like going back to the point you were making about the meeting this morning, Mick, on foreign interference and that, because I thought you made a good point there about how, you know, anybody speaking up against the narrative has been demonised. And in fairness, now we got a few kicks levied at us this morning, but they were pretty lightweight. I think they didn't really land. But one of the interesting thing that a load of MEPs made was that how utterly shocking it was that it didn't matter where you went in Latin America or Africa. They were buying this Russian propaganda. They're not on our page on the Ukraine war. They're buying this Russian propaganda. And we made the point, sorry now, they're not just stupid because they're from Africa or Latin America. They actually have a different view because they've been at the receiving end of imperialist wars and aggression, and the international community didn't give a shit about them or anything. So they're not awake to thinking this is the biggest crime ever, because they've actually experienced crimes equally bad, if not worse. And I thought that hypocrisy kind of thing came out again today. We had these so-called experts who couldn't answer anything. I mean, they went in and they sort of said, oh, Russian disinformation to their domestic market. Like they kind of, for example, go, oh, they're all Nazis. And I said, well, like, sorry now, it's very interesting that you said that now. I said, because while we wouldn't agree with Putin that Ukraine needs to be denazified, that's obviously nonsense, and the whole of Ukraine isn't. But I pointed out to a report done by Bellingcat, who were one of the speakers on the far right in Ukraine, and I quoted from a document where they verified that although the numbers of neo-Nazis in Ukraine are small, their influence is immense, that they've managed to morph into the army and all of these other things. And when the speakers came back in, your man said, you see, we've heard this usual Russian propaganda here again going on about Nazis. I mean, come on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but he refused to deal with Claire's point that Bellingcat themselves, before the war, were admitting that Ukraine was a basket case. There was a strong neo-Nazi element that was very influential in the country, and that it was infiltrating the army. But now that's all been blanked. And I made the point as well that Western leaders and media are telling us that Ukraine is fighting to defend democracy from authoritarian Russia. And I said to him, we know that Russia is authoritarian and that there is internal repression in Russia, and it's got worse since the war went on. Right. And I admitted that Russia is led by a right-wing neoliberal nationalist. But I said, we also know that Zelensky has banned the anti-war opposition parties. He's ripped up labour rights in Ukraine. He's shut down media outlets that don't agree with him. And he's putting his country up for sale to Western capital. And they're instituting sweeping neoliberal reforms that will be detrimental for the people of Ukraine in the long term. Ukraine is being sold to Western big financial interests. This is going to be terrible for the people of Ukraine. But you can't talk about that now, They don't want to talk about that. They don't want to talk about, it's a war situation, right? This notion that this is democracy versus authoritarianism is the greatest fantasy I have ever seen.
Did you see the bit, the green one? The German Greens are the biggest warmongers in Europe, apart from the Baltics and the Poles. But the green one who came in and criticised the Bulgarians who at the UN provided a side room to talk to the Russians and everything. And we said, how is this war ever going to end unless somebody sits down and talks to the Russians? There has to be a space for dialogue in this. But Bulgaria was getting criticised for that. But it's actually getting scary when we think now that obviously Russia has escalated. They've now introduced conscription and a draft, and many people are fleeing from that situation. And contrary to the media and Baltic characterization of people who refuse to fight as draft dodgers, to me, it's always been a very noble gesture, a brave gesture, to refuse to engage in warfare when it's just your leaders who benefit. It's of no benefit to working people anywhere to go and be cannon fodder for their government's battles. So they deserve refuge in Europe under normal morality and norms of international law, where somebody has been the risk of political persecution, they should have the right to asylum. And instead, we see European countries responding by saying, shut the borders, keep them in, it's their fault, they have to get rid of Putin. Now, these are the biggest interferers around the world who interfere in every country, saying, no, keep the Russians there, lock the door and throw away the key. I mean, these people are nuts. They're anti-Russian racists, like, at this stage. And it is a NATO agenda to crush Russia, and it's just a nonsense.
I mean, and how shocking to hear Irish MEPs buy into that line. I mean, can you imagine if someone had said during the Iraq war, where over 1 million citizens, not army people, citizens were killed by the US-NATO war. Over 1 million. And no one suggested that the American athletes wouldn't be allowed to participate in competition. No one suggested that America wouldn't be allowed to play in football tournaments. No one suggested that we should put sanctions on America. No one suggested that we stop the Americans coming to Ireland for holidays. What is gone wrong with the place?
Exactly. And there Micheál Martin gets up at the UN Security Council and says Russia should lose its seat on the Security Council, when he never made a similar call for all of those awful wars that you've mentioned, Mick. Like, he's absolutely a total embarrassment and disgrace in terms of the behaviour of someone at the helm of a neutral country.
Millions were displaced in Afghanistan. He supported the war. Millions displaced and over 1 million killed in Iraq, and he supported it. Millions displaced in Libya and the country destroyed. That's a basket case. He supported the war. He has nothing to say about the war in Yemen, where over 16 million people are starving, according to the UN, and over 400,000 now have been killed. He has nothing to say about that. Mm. And he's obsessed with the Ukraine war. Mm. Why? I agree. I think he's actually looking for some sort of a job from some of the war industry.
Boot licking to his European masters as well. He wants to be the best little European in class, which is really interesting, because it's coming at a time now where, and actually I spoke at an event in the Liverpool, the World Transformed event on a United Ireland, but actually the ducks are all being lined up that we are the nearest to achieving a United Ireland than at any time since partition. But the irony is that many of the drivers behind it, because elements of the Irish business class are behind that, want to see a United Ireland that is a little EU neoliberal statelet, like probably in NATO. And is this what Connolly died for? I don't think so, you know, but that's a discussion for another day. But in any case.
That's all very interesting.
I know it's a bit overwhelming, but that Micheál Martin has that impact on people. He kind of, you know, what can you say?
David De Valera must be turning over and and over in his grave.
Fianna Fáil are actually worse on this war than Fine Gael. And we all know they're like, it's just absolute. Fine Gael seem to have hung on to some semblance that kind of represent the views of Irish people. But actually Fianna Fáil have just hook, line and sinker.
Yeah, going
we're
home.
NATO babes and EU darlings.
Yeah, very much so. So just before we wrap up, there was one other committee, Mick, that you were keen to talk about, a discussion on methane, the new regulation that's coming
down. Well, it was actually, it was an event on Tuesday night in the Parliament, and it was organised by Jutta Paulus, who was a Green from Germany. She's actually very good on environment issues. She's really strong. She works very hard, and I'd have a lot of respect for her, I would, on environmental issues. And the whole thing was on methane. Now, methane has kind of gone under the radar for years, and we haven't really dealt with it. But right now, methane is responsible for over 25% of global warming today, and over 30% of it historically, right? And the scientists have said that cutting methane emissions is the fastest way to slow global warming. Now, in the EU, and the reason this has been discussed is that there's methane legislation going through the Parliament at the moment. In Europe, the sectors most responsible for methane emissions are agriculture, 53%, waste, 26%, and energy is 19%. Right. Now, with this delegation, the Commission is only dealing with energy. Right. Now, and that's good. It's a start. But obviously, it's only 19% of it. And we need to address our very high methane emissions. But now, on top of that, then, so we're looking at 19% of energy. But they're only looking at introducing legislation that will penalise methane emissions to a point where companies, it'll be profitable for them to stop emitting them. Right. But the big problem is that we are not going to apply the same rules to imports. And you have to remember that Ireland is importing over 90% of its gas and over 90% of its oil. And we're not going to deal with the imports. And the big problem with imports and with all oil and gas extraction is that the vast majority of the methane is emitted in the early at the early stages of extraction. So the damage will be done before the fossil fuel will actually even arrive at EU borders. And we're not going to put manners on the companies producing and selling these fossil fuels to us. And some people were saying, oh, well, you know, it's going to be hard to tell other countries what to do. And rightly so. But we don't have to tell other countries what to do. We have to put manners on the companies, not the countries. And in all these countries that are extracting fossil fuel, it isn't the countries themselves that are doing it, it's companies. And they're companies that are operating in Europe. And if they're going to operate in Europe, they should abide by European rules. And you must remember, I mean, this isn't an idea that's fallen out of the sky, right? The EU has already got well-tested regimes for imports in other areas, for example, for food, right? There's a whole lot of food, and like, for example, there's food that that can't come into Europe now if it's sprayed with this or that and whatever, right? Now, obviously, there's still too many pesticides being allowed, but a whole lot of them have been banned. And we monitor what food is coming in, and we penalise the producer in such a way that it will discourage him from not doing it cleanly. And we're doing the same with cars. We're doing the same with chemicals. Why can't we do it with fossil fuel? We've got to do this, right? Methane is going to be a huge issue. And just my last point, right? Just people will find this amazing, right? But speaking of methane, right? The worst fossil fuel for methane emission is fracked gas, liquid, which becomes LNG before it reaches Europe most of the time, right? So the war started on the 24th of February. This year. On the 25th of February, the LNG lobbyists wrote to the White House Energy Department and asked for certain conditions to be dropped so that they could actually produce LNG faster to feed the market in Europe and take advantage of the fact that there was a war with Russia. Now, their list of demands included They were looking for a license to drill on more US public land. They were looking for swift approval of proposed gas export terminals. And they wanted to put pressure on the Federal Energy Regulator Commission in America to greenlight pending gas pipelines. And within 6 weeks, Biden's government caved in on all of them, right? And there's a huge expansion of LNG already. There's two, they've given planning permission for four new terminals to deal with frack gas in the Gulf of Mexico, and two of them have started already. And Europe is doing deals to buy LNG from America that will lead to the fracking, which is an absolutely filthy gas, causing untold environmental trouble and disaster for the communities where they live near the drilling, right? But on top of that, in most cases, with the new terminals that are being built, it'll be about 4 to 5 years before any gas will come from them to Europe. More crazy lock-in. We're doing deals now because of a war that's happening now that, pray to God, will be over before then, right? But we're locking ourselves in to buying filthy, fracked LNG from America for years to come because of the position that we've taken on a war that we could have stopped. We've made no effort to stop. In an actual fight, there's reports coming out only this week where the US and EU have blocked peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine on three occasions since the war started. We'll deal with that next week.
Yeah, I think it just shows something that you've been talking about for a while on the podcast and elsewhere, how quickly fossil fuel lobbies have and arms lobbies have ran to take advantage of this. And that report really just shows how quickly that happened. It was the day after.
Yeah. And then mysteriously, we have the Nord Stream 2 infrastructure exploding again, damaging a supply. Well, absolutely. And then damaging the prospect of a supply in the future from Russia back to Europe and leading Europe to be ever more dependent on American LNG.
And it was gas because some of the MEPs praised America for attacking the pipeline and more than blamed the Russians for doing it. They're a bit confused. They're not sure who to blame yet.
No, but we're all glad that the US has offered its services to help in an investigation. So no doubt the truth will come out.
That'll be independent. Yeah, that'll be great. Yeah, love that one.
Yeah. Very good. Well, until next week. Goodbye. Till next week.
Bye bye.
Adios.